I also want to express my appreciation to each of you for being here tonight and express my appreciation to the congregation for inviting me to be with you on this particular, at this particular time and on this particular subject. I want tonight to begin by making somewhat of an explanation of perhaps the way that I will be dealing with this lesson tonight. Those of you who have heard me preach before know that I generally do not preach with massive notes, and I really would prefer preaching with a 3x5 card. But if you'll see tonight, I do have a great deal of notes. And what I'm going to be doing tonight, I'm sure, will be doing quite a lot of reading from these notes. Now, really, there's two reasons for this, and I want to explain them. And that is, first of all, I really don't know how emotional this lesson will be tonight. I'll say something just a little bit later on about the emotionalism of it. But one never knows how emotional they will get. And so I wanted to come totally prepared in case that happens, that I will not get off of track and be able to go ahead and say those things that will be beneficial for you. I was talking to Al this afternoon and told him that I firmly expect to get through the lesson without any breakdown. And then tonight, as he was telling me about my wife's death, or as he was talking there, it began to hit, as you can see now. Little things like that does hit you without you ever realizing it. And so that is one reason for the notes and being reading it a lot. The other is because there are so many things that I want to tell you that I feel is of great importance. And if we do not go through them in somewhat of a detailed way in reading it, I know that I will elaborate a little too long on this or that and not be able to tell you those things that I would like to do. And so tonight and tomorrow night, I will be reading a great deal from my notes. The latter three lessons will be of a different nature, and I truly believe that each lesson will really become more exciting and help you to appreciate not only what you have to go through, but what death, from the biblical viewpoint, really is. It has been a pleasure to me, really, to be forced to take my notes and boil them down to speak to you, and you will be the first audience that I will be speaking to on this particular subject in this way. And that is that during the first year after her death, I took massive notes of every feeling that I had every day during that period of time. I read every book that I could possibly find. I, first of all, went to the bookstores and bought everything they had and read them. Went to the county libraries and read them. And then I have a friend that works in the Capitol at Olympia. And he went to the library and began to check them out and bring them to me by the armloads, as many as he could carry. One day he came in and they had the computer readout of the books that I'd had. And he said, I want to check and make sure that we got all of these. And he threw them out, and it was about 10 or 12 feet long. I really didn't count the number of books. I have no idea. But at any rate, he became so popular down there that in their computer, they redlined the books. And any new book they redline, bring out, and I'm the first guy that gets to read it. And so I merely say that to you to let you know that I have gone through the past few weeks a massive amount of notes and tried to break them down in just a few pages that we'll be able to study tonight. And so I trust that will explain why I will be going through it in somewhat of a detailed way like this. Now as we turn to the tension tonight, I want to begin by saying this indeed is a very different subject than we're used to having as we assemble ourselves together. And I know that probably in your mind the question has arisen, is it a scriptural subject? Is it necessary? Why are we studying it? And if it is necessary, why haven't we heard about it before? If it is something of such a of great importance. One day, during the first 6 months of my taking notes, I sat down and here are the notes that I wrote. And that is, I just wrote down a note to try to impress on the people that I was talking to at that time the fact that there is suffering all around us. And here are the notes. I'll read them very rapidly. And that is, starting out, I said, last Friday, 3 people died on I-5. Saturday, 53 people died in a fire at a soccer game. Sunday morning, we were told about a young lady from the church there that had gone into the cancer clinic in Seattle. She died a few days later. Sunday, one man was struck by lightning on a ball diamond. The same day, 85 people were killed in riots and 24 people were killed when their bus turned over. These are but a few of the 72,000 people who died on Saturday and the 72,000 who died again on Sunday. Each year, 500,000 teenagers attempt to commit suicide. 5,000 succeed every year. In the past few days, I have had two to come that I have had to deal with myself. Again, then I continue to write. I was to have lunch with John Cogdell on Monday morning. As I was getting ready to make arrangements to meet him, the phone rang. It was his wife, Beverly, telling me that John's wife, dad, had died the night before, and that was Roy Cogdell, and he was flying to Houston for his funeral. On Tuesday of the same week, Donna Smith, one of our members, called me at 9 o'clock, saying her mother had deteriorated from cancer to the point that she thought that her daughter was trying to murder. She, at that moment, was lying on the floor calling for Lowell to come. At noon today, Brother Darty, a preacher of many, many years, went to sleep at the dinner table and died in his sleep. I received a call at 6:30 a.m. today telling me a sister in Christ had died in Cottage Grove, Oregon. She was 40 years of age. This evening, I received word from Mike Bryant that his little two-year-old daughter had have open-heart surgery. And I pointed to the people, since talking with you last week, the following has happened. 72,000 people die every day in this world. In the past 7 days, here in the United States, we've had 504,000 people die. If each person left an average of only 10 loved ones to grieve over them, there would be 5,040,000 new grievers every week. Each year, there are 237,000 new widowers, 506,000 new widows, totaling 743,000 people that are left without their mates in America every year. And that does not include the sons and the daughters and the grandparents that are left behind. The average American wife spends 18 years of her life as a widow. One out of four widows is under the age of 45. As you see, I'm just reading you bare facts to show that suffering is all around us. Now I've come down to this day. Last Saturday, right, I'm talking about now this past Saturday, my 42-year-old sister had a stroke, and last Saturday night I was making plane reservations to go to Illinois and getting ready to call the elders here to have to cancel this meeting. Two or three nights before, my mother had almost lost her life on two separate occasions. Tuesday night, that's night before last, I sat after class with two parents with a 14-year-old boy that had a brain tumor in the middle of his brain. We were trying to determine what would be the best to do. Would it be the best to have an operation, which will be performed at 10 o'clock in the morning, to where they would take out the tumor and leave him a vegetable? Would they not do anything and he would die for between 2 days and 2 weeks? Or will they put shunts in and relieve the pressure, let the tumor grow, and then he will die in the next few years? We wrestled with that problem on Tuesday night. Yes, there is such a thing as grief in this world. I've merely read you a few things that's happened in my life here in just a week's time. But we might say, wait. All of that doesn't take into account the tens of thousands of divorces each year, the hundreds of thousands of serious accidents and illnesses, the 20,160 businesses who go bankrupt every year, and on we could go with people who have to suffer and grieve over their losses. If you believe that there is not a great amount of grief in divorce, read Malachi chapter 2, verses 12 through 14. And there God says that the tears of those women were covering his altar, and he was crying out, "I hate divorce." Do you know that 70% of all parents who have children that die of cancer end up getting a divorce because of the grief that goes after that death? And even if there is not death of children, just rebellious children and disobedient, read Proverbs 17:25, Genesis 26:35, 2 Samuel 13:39, 1 Samuel 11:26, and there you find parents who had all of these children that it says brought them down into great grief. And so we can begin to see, yes, grief is all around us. Grief is something that we have to deal with. But then we come back and we ask the question, is this subject a scriptural subject? Is it something that we ought to be talking about in a church building, in a meeting such as this? Let me call your attention to the fact that the word death, die, and dead are used over 950 times in the Bible. Now, these are shocking things as I sat down to begin to just realize and analyze how much the Bible has to say about the subject. The word grief, which is our topic tonight, is used 75 times, and its companion word mourn is used hundreds of times. And so we can see the way the Bible uses these terms. In the process of my lessons here, I intend to quote to you 198 scriptures that deal with these particular passages. And so I think we can see we are dealing with a biblical topic. Let me suggest a couple passages that we look at very rapidly. And on these, obviously, I'm not going to have time to stop and analyze them. They are passages that are very simple to understand, but they're passages that every one of us read over very, very rapidly. For instance, almost any young child can answer the question, what is the shortest verse in the Bible? I remember one of the first things I ever learned. It was Jesus wept. Everybody knows that. But do you know the surrounding circumstances of it? Does it really mean anything to you when you read verses such as this? That verse in John 11, verse 33, it said, when Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping who came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and said, where have you laid him? And they said unto him, Lord, come and see. And Jesus wept. Friend, that was a mournful situation. That was a tearful occasion that means something to someone after they've gone through a grief like that. In Acts the 9th chapter, verse 38, when a Christian widow or lady had died, it said the disciples, hearing that Peter was there, sent two men unto him, entreating him, delay not to come unto us. That's not unlike us today, is it? When somebody dies, we send for somebody that we admire. We send for the preachers, the elders, or someone, and say, hurry and come over. It said, and Peter arose and went with them, and when he was come, they brought him into the upper chamber or the upper bedroom, and all the widows stood by him, weeping, showing the coats and the garments which Dorcas made while she was with them. Indeed, a terrible, mournful situation that night. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13, it says, but we would not have you ignorant, brethren, concerning them that fall asleep or die, that you sorrow not, even as the rest who have no hope. Wherefore, comfort one another with these words. Now, I want you to note here that this passage does not say that when a Christian dies, the loved ones will not sorrow. It doesn't say that at all. It said, I want you to understand from the teaching of the Word of God that you are not to suffer and sorrow even as the rest who have no hope. I really am unable to comprehend what a suffering is of people that do not understand that their loved one has a hope of being with God. And so that's what he's saying there, that Christians are to suffer. They are to mourn. The Bible is full of it. But we're to learn a lesson. We're to learn something so that it is not as those that are without Christ. Now, may I suggest to you that when a preacher goes to Palestine and takes a lot of pictures and comes back, so many times we ask him to show his slides, and we say, tell us what it is like at Jerusalem. And when it talks about the Mount of Olives, let me see it so that I can kind of visualize it there. Would it not also be wise, as we have assembled together to do tonight, if somebody has taken a trip into the valley of the shadow of death and has felt that and knows what it feels like, for us to ask him to tell us a little bit about it? Because we're going to get so much more from that than we are from any pictures of any dirt or any city that we could possibly have. We have classes on how to teach somebody to become a Christian. Do we have classes on how to teach somebody to go to a loved one who's lost a parent or a child or a spouse, and what to say? Do you really feel comfortable? Do you know what to do when you get a call that somebody has lost their wife and you say, let me go? I'm prepared. I can go into that house and I know what to say and I know how to act. And I think that is going to be the value of this, because I'm going to show you, and I think that I can say it in without any contradiction at all and prove it to you. I'm going to show you, and you can leave knowing, what do you do And so it can be a situation that can help us as we go in and help other people. Do you realize how many times the Bible talks about the shadow of death? I didn't. Had you asked me, I'd have said, well, one time Psalms 23 would come to my mind. And how shocked I was when the concordance says it is used 18 times. And so there is such a thing as walking through that shadow of death. But if it's so necessary, we raise the question, why hasn't the subject been talked about before? Now listen carefully to what I have to say, because this is what all the books say, all the doctors, what everybody says. Really, there are two reasons. First, the subject of actual death and grief has been a subject Americans have hidden for years. We are known the world around as the death-denying society. Never has a nation refused to face this subject as adamantly as we have for the past 50 years. There was a time when people died at home and their bodies remained at home until the burial. I well remember the corpse of my little sister, who died about 52 years ago, laid in our living room for 3 days and three nights, and people sat with that body around the clock 24 hours a day. But soon after, about 50 years ago, we in America began to change the whole structure of death and what to do. And your morticians are crying out, and it is a problem to them. And that is that we began to change it, and we became a death-denying society. We moved the body out of the home into a funeral home. We stopped sitting with the corpse. The mortician goes to Great Lake to make up the body so it will appear to still be alive. We comment on how nice the corpse looks and are very disappointed if the corpse appears to be dead. Every effort is made to make the death and the funeral as fast and pretty as it can be. We equip attending funerals except when we had to. Today, the average funeral, are you ready for this? A mortician told me the other day, said, Lowell, the average funeral today has 30 people attending it. We leave the funeral and urge the survivors to keep their chin up and go on with life. We admire those who appear to be the least affected. We comment on how strong they are because that's the American way. And Christians think that the spiritually minded means that we'll grieve less and get over it quicker. Homer Haley called me the day after my wife died. I'll never forget one thing he said. You know his direct approach. He said, Lowell, some of the brethren will tell you that the Lord will fill the void in your life. You won't be lonesome because the Lord will take her place. Don't you believe that, boy. That's a bunch of nonsense. It's not the Lord's purpose to take the place of a wife, and he won't do it. You're going to miss her, and you need to find another wife as quickly as you can. Don't you believe the brethren when they say that. And of course, he had said it from experience. He'd also lost his wife when he was my age. Psychologists today have found that this American attitude has damaged our society and caused emotional breakdowns later in life. In a recent study in Dallas, Texas, it was found that those who did not grieve properly, and I want you to note that, there is a way that you grieve properly, and we want to talk about that. Now, it said those who did not grieve properly at the time of the death of their loved ones had emotional problems and had to seek professional help as long as 30 years later. Today, psychologists will teach you that you will grieve. You will grieve now or later. If you do not do it properly now, you will suffer for years, and then it will come out. We now know that we're setting on a psychological time bomb as a nation. By being a death-denying nation, we're causing millions to become emotional cripples. You and I are part of that nation and that society. Now, should we not recognize the consequence along with the heathen world and begin facing the subject? And this is the first reason we don't hear about it. It's against our culture today. But I'm thankful that that is changing. There are many, many associations and many, many classes and seminars that are held now in hospitals and around the world trying to get people to understand the necessity of really grieving. But secondly, another reason why we haven't heard about it is that who will speak on the subject? It's a very limiting subject because the person would have to experience it before he could teach it. There's absolutely no way a person can understand the feelings unless they've lost either a spouse or a child. Now, losing a parent or a friend causes grief, but all studies prove that there's nothing like losing a spouse or a child. Nothing else in the scripture, or in the experience of man, compares to this grief. I'm telling you this from the studies of mankind, that that is the most devastating thing that will happen in your life, is when you lose a child or when you lose a spouse. I have lost two sisters. I've lost a father. And there is nothing that even starts to compare to just the first few seconds that I went through when they came in and said, "We've lost her." One other thing that limits it is that the one who loses a spouse or a child would have to be a public speaker of some sort. It would be impossible for one who is not used to speaking to the public to automatically become such in the middle of a horrible agony. Since only a few preachers have lost their wife, it stands to reason that there's only a few who could speak on the subject, even if they desired. Now, I realized this dilemma the week after Doris died, and I immediately decided that I would teach a class each week on what happened to me and how I felt. I had no idea what would happen. I told the class that I had no idea what would happen, and it might even be embarrassing, but I would tell them about my life and feelings each week. They could watch me as I talked and cried. They could share my agony, and they could watch me as I healed. In this matter, they could come as close as possible to experiencing the agony of grief, and they could prepare themselves at least in a small way to deal with the pain when it happened to them. This I did. And those classes are on tape if you'd like to order them. I've never had so many positive responses to anything in all of my life. Without exception, every person said it was not only an unusual event, but also a very profitable experience. I'll just share a couple of things that not too long ago, there were two widows in California. They had lost their husbands and they were just devastated. They had quit attending services regularly. They used to be Bible class teachers. They quit teaching the Bible, and these were pillars in the church. And they were just emotional cripples, and people were worrying about them. And the preacher there heard about these tapes, and so he got the tapes and gave them to them. And those women wrote me, and all of a sudden, in just a matter of about 2 or 3 weeks, I began to get letters from them, and then I got letters from the preacher there, and said that there absolutely is no way to explain what happened. As they went through and they were able to relate that, as they were able to hear me as I poured out my heart on a weekly basis telling the unusual things that happened, they wrote and they said, "We cried and we laughed and we could relate." And they said, "You can't imagine how it helps." And week after next, one of them is going to the Canadian Expo, just as happy as can be, back in church, teaching Bible classes, and going to stop by, and I'll have the privilege of meeting her face to face at that time. And so all that I'm saying is that sharing your grief, understanding grief, can help people. That's happened the country over of people writing those letters. I have a whole list of people see that. So let's understand how important such a thing as this really is. But I'd warn you, however, that those tapes are filled with tears and agony and pain. If you do not want to experience a man going through grief, don't order them. In those tapes, I attempted to explain all my feelings, not only my pains, but my improvements, my sexual feelings, my feelings toward marriage and remarriage, humorous things that happened to me, and so forth and so on. Tonight, as I was getting dressed, something hit me. I was folding a handkerchief, and I'd bought three new handkerchiefs there. In fact, I bought nine new handkerchiefs, I think it was, for this meeting. But at any rate, I laid out a handkerchief and folding it out and going to put it in there. And I looked at it, and all of a sudden it hit me that I don't remember exactly what it was. But I do know that about the second or third week as I was teaching the class, why I told the people, I said, "I'm bound to be getting better." Because in the first class, I think I went through 7 handkerchiefs, and tonight I only went through 4. And so, needless to say, I have a handkerchief in every pocket tonight. Now, in this series, I'll try to share the highlights of those things and try to do it without shedding tears. Right here would be a good place to make an explanation. It has now been 18 months since my wife died, and I'm sufficiently healed so that I do not think I'll break down and cry, at least not very much. Let me assure you that if I do, it will be unintentional. I cannot, however, guarantee you that I won't, because no one ever knows what will trigger the reaction. It can be just a word or a thought and tears pop out and flow. Now, if this does happen, be assured that all is well and I'll recover quickly. If it does happen, don't feel sorry for me. Just sit back and enjoy yourself, because the tears are a natural thing. I say that with all sincerity. Don't get upset at all. Now, back to grief. Our attitude has been to cover up the subject by not talking about it. We all dread it and hope that it doesn't come to us. We all intentionally know that it will, but emotionally we'll not face it. Those of you who are here tonight are a special group of Americans. I congratulate you for attending this series when it would be so easy to put it the other way. But if you do not study this subject, I assure you, and do not face it, that you are doing some damage to yourself. And that is that you're refusing to face the subject and preparing yourself. I went into it the same way. I had preached funerals. I had done the same thing that everybody does. When I went to visit the person, I didn't know what to say. I felt totally awkward. I went up and just felt totally at loss because I wanted to say something that would remove the burden. I preached the sermon. I dreaded going by the graveyard. And when I got in the car to go home, I'd wipe my brow and I'd say, I'm glad that's over. I could leave and I could go then somewhere and the grieving person would go on home. I didn't know what to do. I was totally lost. And I went on through life in that way. And when they came out that night, and when they said, we lost her, just like that, I am in a world I don't know anything about. Nobody's ever told me what it will feel like. I went through events that one night that I could not possibly describe in words. I'll try. But you're in a world that is absolutely beyond belief. Why didn't somebody tell me? Is the feeling that you have. That's the reason that I began immediately wanting to tell people and show people so that when it happened to them, it'll not lessen your pain at all. You will have every bit as much pain after listening to me as you would have had you never come. But at least when you walk in that world, you'll know that you're not going crazy. And that is an important thing to do. And so it's very important to prepare yourself and understand that some very strange things are going to happen. Now let me hasten to say that in the things that I talk about in this series and I tell you about, I'm not going to be making up things. And I'm not going to tell you things that just happened to me that doesn't happen to everybody else. In fact, after reading these books, I don't know of one thing that's happened to me that hadn't happened to everybody else. Haven't found one solitary thing. And everything that I say to you, I'm assuring you that I can back it up with proof. I can read to you study after study after study after study with thousands of people showing you everything I say. It may sound weird. It may sound bizarre. And you may say, that fellow just saying that to try to be graphic and to try. No, I can back it up. All you have to do is to go down to your state library and just read and just pull out one book and read one book. And you can find that all of these things that are in there. And so be prepared because you're going to go through the same thing that I did. Now, another thing, if we don't study it, we won't understand several hundred scriptures. There have been scripture after scripture that have just popped in my mind that I see now what it means because I was skipping over it before. You can read over those things so rapidly. And I hope to be able to present the last three lessons, some of the Bible teachings about death and some things that I never realized before. But I believe that you can see it's written down in that book just as plainly as baptism for remission of sins. Another thing is that we can't understand the character of God if we do not understand what grieving is, because God is a grieving God. Would you like to know, out of all the studies that have been made, they've asked and they said, who helped you the least out of all the people around you, everybody you know, when you lost your mate, who helped you the least? And there were two groups of people that rated equally at the number one of the list. They were the preachers and the doctors in every survey that was made. And it would shock me at how, when this happened, my colleagues, preachers of the gospel, began to back off, and I never saw them. They didn't know what to say. I have no hard feelings. That's the reason I can say it tonight. I'm not rebuking anybody because I'm one of you. Because that's the way I felt. That's the way I felt 1 second before I heard those words. I understand the situation. But what I'm saying is, it is a pathetic thing if we don't face the subject and study the subject so we can walk in and know what to do in a case like that. Listen to Solomon, Ecclesiastes 7:2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools in the house of myrrh. Now my grief, and then we're going to get to the lesson. I want to say that I have not suffered more than any other. As I'm telling you these stories tonight, I do not want you to go home and say, well, Lowell came down and he's feeling sorry for himself, because I'm not. There is not one thing that I have suffered that every other widower or widow in this audience tonight, and there are several in here, that has not suffered. You can pull aside any person that's lost their spouse and ask them, if I exaggerated any point tonight, and you will find that they'll say, he didn't say one thing that I didn't experience. And the only problem is, he didn't tell it bad enough. That's what you will find that they will say. Now, I consider myself the most fortunate man in all the world. And I want to say this honestly, and I'm not saying it humbly. I'm saying it honestly because I believe it's true. 1 week before Doris died, we were talking. I believe it was providentially. We had always joked around about death, and I'd always talked to her, you know, and said, you know, honey, if you ever die, you know, I'm going to marry the prettiest, richest, and so forth. And we would joke like this, and there'd be a pretty girl go by, and she'd look at me, you know, and say, boy, you're looking for the day, you know, that I die, aren't you? We had all this thing that all of you have. But that night, we had some talks, and I'll not talk about all of them. It was very interesting. But she said, honey, I'm beginning to see what you mean when you think about your death. I've been thinking about my death for about 4 or 5 years, almost on a daily basis. And I talked to her, but she didn't relate to it. So she was talking, and she said, you know, I've been thinking. She said, I have diabetes, and do you know that right now is the best time in our life for me to die? And my wife never joked. And I looked at her with shock and said, what do you mean? And she said, I'm serious. Right now is the best time in our life for me to die. And I said, you're crazy. I couldn't live without you. There's no way I could live without you. Why would you say that? And she said, well, it really is. She said, I'm 51. In the next 10 years, I'm going to have a lot of problems with this diabetes. And I would hinder you in your work in preaching. And he said, our children are raised and they're married. And you're young enough now to where you could make a good life for yourself. And right now would be the best time. She told me that on a Thursday night after class. We talked a little bit about some other things, about death. And she got up and went to bed. And I sat there and meditated on those things she said. Monday night, her heart began to bother her. Tuesday night, we took her to the emergency. Wednesday, she had a test. Thursday, they tried to cure it. Friday, we had her in 3 hospitals. And 10:10 that night, she died. Those words that she said are true. I can stand before you tonight, God is my witness, and say I'm a very fortunate man. I'm fortunate that she died without a great deal of suffering. I'm fortunate she died while I am in good health. I'm fortunate she died while I'm young enough to make a new life. I'm fortunate that I'm old enough that our children are out of home. There's not one bad thing you could think about me as a widower. You do not know of one other human being who's ever lost his wife that could be more fortunate than I. I say that. God is my witness. And so I'm saying it to let you know, I'm not going to say any of these things for sympathy's sake. I'm merely saying them because they're true. Now let's go to grieving. What is it? Webster defines it as suffering or mental suffering from bereavement. Now, that doesn't mean a thing to you if you haven't lost a spouse or a child. Mental anguish or suffering from bereavement. What I want to do is to try to show what that really means, so that when we take a look at the word grief, we will see some things it means. Let me read you some passages of Scripture very, very rapidly to show you some ways that the Bible uses the word grief. In Isaiah 53:3, talking about Jesus, he was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Jeremiah 10:19, woe is me because of my hurt. My wound is grievous. But I said truly, this is my grief, and I must bear it. And Psalms 31:10, have mercy upon me, O Jehovah, for I am in distress. Mine eye wasteth away with grief. Yea, my soul and my body, for my life is spent with sorrow or grief, and my years with sighing. And on and on and on it goes, talking about these various things. My time is getting away from me. Let me just skip on down to some others here that I'd read to you, just a whole page that I'll skip. Here we could have in 1 Samuel 30 and verse 3, it says, then David and the people that were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. You see, grief is where you hurt so badly that you feel that your eyes are going to be torn out, and where you cry until you can't cry anymore, but you hurt just as bad. That's what the Bible teaches. David cried out when his son was dead or killed. Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom. Would I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son. And it says the king grieved for his son, and the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice. Oh, my son Absalom, my son. You're going to do this when a loved one dies. I well remember the first time that I went into the house alone. I fell on the living room floor. I couldn't help it. I yelled and I screamed for my wife and for my God to comfort me. I understand. These words were real when David was screaming for his son. And on it goes in Psalms 89:9. David said, mine eye wasteth away by reason of affliction. And so the Bible teaches that grief and affliction is a very, very terrible thing. We can read those passages. And how many times have we read them about, oh, Absalom, my son, or my bed swims in tears, one of them that I skipped on over. How many times have we read it, but didn't really realize they meant what they said? And how many times do we read it and understand that one half of us tonight will go through that with our spouse? It's the fortunate one that will go on and be left. Now then, I want to ask now, what did they feel? What is grief? What really happens when you go into grief? Let me suggest a rather strange thing to you right now. That grief is God's plan for the mind to heal. That grief is the only way that a loving human mind can heal. There is no way on this earth that you can love a mate or love a child and lose that child without going through these things that we're going to be talking about step by step and heal and come out a normal individual. What I call healing grief. It's not just grief, it's healing grief. When you cut yourself, if you cut your arm, you look at it and first of all, it's very ugly and the wound is open and it bleeds. And then a little while, there's going to be a scab. Now, if you're vain, and if you say, oh, look at that nasty scab, I want to go to town, and you pick off the scab. And every time it scabs over, you pick off the scab so your arm won't look so badly. What will happen to your arm? It will never heal. And the same thing is true with grief. That if, lest we go through it, and when we're wounded in our mind, unless we scab over, and grieving is ugly, it's embarrassing to the people around about you. But unless you go through it the way God intended, friend, your mind will not heal. And so I call it healing grief. It's absolutely necessary. Grief is a real thing. The medical profession wrestles with it. And they say that it's not a disease, but it acts like a disease. And so there's two things that they classify separately. Two things that most people need doctor's attention of where it is not a disease. You know what they are? Pregnancy. Is pregnancy a disease? Think about it. No. No, pregnancy is not a disease, but you need medical attention. And grief is not a disease, but you need attention in somehow. As you began to look at grief being in this, let me give you some things to show you that grief is a real thing. The first year that a man loses his wife, and I'm going to turn it around probably tomorrow night and talk a little bit about it, but the first year a man loses his wife, the death rate of that particular age group shoots up as high as 10 times the rest of the people his age. Is he going through anything? When I cried over my wife, it was a scary thing. I had a chemical smell that would fill my nostrils. And I could tell for months after, when I was just absolutely torn with tears, this horrible, horrible smell. It didn't smell like gasoline. It smelled differently, but it's like you'd soak a handkerchief in gasoline and stick it to my nose, that's what would go through my head. It was a real thing. I read, quote, "Medical researchers have not yet counted all the things that happen within you when emotional tears come to your eyes. All they know is that your whole body is affected. Your blood chemistry, skin color, muscle reflex, and probably every gland. There are illnesses that come, great long list of illnesses that come with people who are in grieving. Here are some that I had. Weight, gain or loss. I lost 40 pounds. Heart problems of murmurs and various things. Breathing. There were times when I would hyperventilate. I'd be driving along the car. And just all of a sudden, it would just come, and I would cry, and I would gasp for air. And you know what? It didn't scare me, because I was hoping I'd die. I'm not exaggerating. I was thinking, maybe this is it. Maybe I will die. But you don't. You get your breath and go on. Chest pains. Many nights I would go home and sit down and have pains through here. And I'd say, I wonder if I'm having a heart attack. And again, one of the blessed things about it is, I wouldn't have called a doctor at all, because I was hoping that would be my last night. And then skin problems. I've always had very smooth skin. And all of a sudden, great big blotches that big around began to pop up all over me. And I let them go for a while, and then went to the doctor and told him. And the doctor says, well, yeah, he says, your immune system, when a mate dies and you go in grief, shuts down. And your immune system just shuts down just like that. And then you're subject to all of these. Grieving is a real thing. That's all that I'm bringing it up for. Let's look at some charts right here very rapidly at really what happens in grief. And this is what I would call healing grief. Grief of a very beautiful nature, where you can heal and come out feeling good again. In grief, there are three different steps that you're going to go through. There's step number one that is called shock, step number two that is called suffering, and step number three that is called recovery. And we'll look at each one of these griefs, because different things happen to you at different times in this particular process. Now, as we look at these very rapidly right here, we could say this, that I put them up there the first time, shock, suffering, and recovery, when really you're in shock to start with. Suffering starts and overlaps your shock. It goes over and you start your recovery while you're in your suffering. And really, I don't know how to diagram it, you see, really any better than that, but to show that some way or another, you fade out of one into the other. It doesn't happen in one day, but certain definite things actually happen to you as you go into that. And so tonight, I want to talk a little bit about this, and tomorrow night, we're going to talk about it even in more detail of what happens to you in each one of these. You have to know what happens to an individual before you know how to help them. All right, now the first stage, the stage of shock. Let me explain the best I can what happens. And that is that when you go to visit a person who's just got word that their mate died, or your mate died, what happens is I went totally numb. And by totally numb, I mean totally numb. It felt exactly like somebody had come up and stuck a electric wire on me with both prods and hit me with all that electricity. I just stiffened out, and I hit the couch, the foot of the couch, until I thought I had knocked it off. When I later went back for a daughter's operation, I went down to the operating room to see if I'd knocked that arm off of the couch. And you just go totally numb. And I thought, it can't be true. And immediately, you're in a new world. Just immediately, You're in a totally new world. I called my kids together and I gave them a speech. I don't remember what all I said. I do know that I said as I looked and stared that Jehovah is given and Jehovah is taken away. Blessed be the name of Jehovah. I told them that Mom and I have tried to live a pure life without reproach. And now then, let us conduct ourselves so we'll never bring shame on that name. And then I told them that I didn't want to interfere within their families, but I wanted them to go ahead and keep their families together. My mind and my body was numb, and there was an immediate and extreme fear of the future. You just go totally numb, and there is a fear